Word to the Wise. We are an explicit podcast tackling content with adult themes and whatnot. This week, we're talking about Dungeon Crawler Carl by Matt Dinneman. Make sure that you've read all the way through. Welcome to Words and Whiskey Short Pours, a monthly-ish podcast where we have a fun time discussing fictional worlds and people that create them, all while boozing just a little bit. My name is Cross.
My name is PJ, and I don't know if we can say monthly-ish at this point. It's been a minute.
No, I just read the copy and I was going like, well, we pretty much just put this on the regular feed anyway, so like, it probably shouldn't. You know, a bonus episode of the show, whatever, whichever way you want to paint it, or, you know, depending on when this comes out for other people outside of our Patreon, you know, a filler episode. So,
yeah. But for those of you who this is intended for, hi, Patreon listeners.
Hello. We are so happy to be speaking to you on this evening. And if you're not, you know, hey, here we are. We are here today to talk about Dungeon Crawler Carl by Matt Dinneman, a sensational book that, well, I should say, a book that has been a sensation, selling its way from an indie darling all the way into now some like crazy publication deals that have never been managed and maintained before. So very excited to talk about it. And also a big thank you to our patron who sponsored this episode, Dad Bod Thor or Kev. Thank you. We're excited to talk about this.
Yeah. Yeah, we are. It's a long time coming.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We read a different book and I could not finish that book. I personally didn't vibe with the other book and we won't besmirch that. So we switched and pivoted. And this was a better read on all accounts. And I finished it, actually, which is a good starting point.
And Crossland, in his wild gestures, revealed that he also has a physical copy of this book.
Yeah.
Which I strictly listened to this book. Crossland has it on audiobook and Kindle and physical, apparently.
Dude, I don't know what it is of late. I do know what it is. I've restricted my social media usage very heavily, and so I instead read a lot on my phone in those kind of same situations where I would be like flipping through things. Mm-hmm. So I've become more of a phone reader than I ever have been before. But the physical copy that I have, which is of the more recent editions that were just released, is a gift that I got from my brother for Christmas. So this was a book that he bought me before we even knew that we were going to read it.
Perfect.
On the show fully. So worked out.
Really cool.
Yeah. That said, I didn't really have time, and we'll get into this more when we talk about this. I didn't really have time to read it physically very much. So I did do it mostly via audio. But yeah. So before we get too much further into this, though, PJ, let's talk about what we're drinking. What are you having on this fine Monday evening?
I crafted myself a legendary mana potion.
Achievement unlocked.
Just a margarita, but with blue curacao, edible glitter. So it's
very nice.
It's a bright blue, sparkly margarita.
Excellent. Similarly, PJ, I am having a common cocktail in honor of Princess Donut, a Negroni. Ooh, I didn't prepare. Hang on. Now, you may be wondering, why did that take so long for Crossland to pour a shot? That would make, generally speaking, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Well, dear PJ, I grabbed my Reikia, being like, I'll do a shot of Reikia. That'll be great. And there was 0.25, like there was quarter of an ounce. I was like, oh, God. Okay, well, that's not enough. And then I grabbed the gin that I used for the last couple of Negronis that I made and poured the rest of it.
So you made yourself a martini.
Yes. In addition, it is 1.5 ounces. 1.5 ounces. So full on cheers.
Cheers.
But yeah.
Terry Mana Tequila. Mm.
Yummy.
Mana potion.
Yummy. Yummy. Do you have a back half beer or anything like that?
I do. It is a straight stout.
Cool.
Or it's Routine by Blackstack. It's just, they have it labeled as a straight stout. It's just a no frills, just a fucking stout, and it's really delicious. It's perfectly done, as Blackstack is known for.
Cool, awesome, that's exciting. I don't have a back half. I have an extra large Negroni.
Sounds good.
So that'll serve. Made a double. It'll be okay. Okay, cool. Well, with that, PJ, let's kick it off with our book summary, and then we'll get into our overall thoughts if you want to read our summary here.
Absolutely. Carl and Princess Donut are forced into a deadly dungeon designed by aliens after the destruction of Dearth. Sorry, Earth.
Earth.
I just wanted to continue the alliteration.
Yeah. This is the story of a girl. This is like a really simplified version of that summary. No, every time I say this is, it just, it's the first thing that pops into my head. Really simplified one. This was from the Wikipedia, though, so I was like, all right, well, that is like a one-line synopsis of pretty much what happens there. But it doesn't explain that Princess Donut is his ex-girlfriend's cat. It doesn't explain that there's like this whole like corporate sort of alien thing that's kind of going on in the background that's interesting, among anything else. But yeah,
I think that's great. If this is a little like teaser, give you the vibe of it without revealing pretty much anything, I think that's a that does the job well.
But I feel like you would at the very least indicate the cat. Maybe not the alien and the other stuff, but you know, indicate that Donut's a cat.
I think you understand that it's not a person.
I don't know, man. Princess Donut, I mean, it could just be an eclectic person, but
yeah, fair. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm with you though. So we generally start these with just sort of overall thoughts. So let's go there. PJ, how did you feel about this book on the whole? What you know, top to bottom?
On the whole, and I think we'll get into my my initial problems with it, or not problems, but I mean, my initial trepidation with it, I think stemmed from the fact that this is a brand new genre to me in general.
Sure.
But by the end of it, I really, really was having a ton of fun with it. I didn't know off the jump that this was a series, let alone a fairly large series.
Yeah.
So I had no idea what I was getting into, and that understanding that I think maybe like three quarters of the way through the book, probably like two thirds of the way through the book, I opened up the audio or Audible that you and I shared and saw the second one. I'm like, oh, and it said like 2 of 7 or something like that. I'm like, oh, okay, nope. All right. This is a much bigger series. And that brought a lot of perspective to me in the pacing of it and in like where we were going and sort of the breadth of the story in general. Yeah. Once I got kind of locked in with the way the genre, like the lit RPG, is that right? Is that the name of the genre? Yeah. That lit kind RPG of functions. I started enjoying it a lot more.
I get you there. I think this book solidified for me that I don't love lit RPG. This is the lightest, one of the lighter lit RPG books that are out there. And I like this book. Don't get me wrong. But I view that as a central flaw that I do not like. But we'll talk a lot more about that precisely later. That is perhaps the only thing that actually knocked this book down significantly for me in my estimation is that I don't want to harp on this for too long, but like I play video games to get that fix, you know, and I read to like do something completely different with my brain, and the overlap there personally is not something that I'm super into. But I am gonna, to the point, like I did buy the second Audible, like I did get the same book, like I'm excited to read more here, and I do like this book. Yeah, I really liked a lot of it. I did struggle getting into it at first, kind of similarly to what you were saying, partially because of the genre tropes, although I knew them. I just still didn't like them. And in part because I think I would have, and I think I did in the end to some degree, enjoyed reading this a little bit more physically as opposed to listening to it. Because some of the things that were grating in the audiobook, I could have visually skipped over. And that would have been, and I would have been more okay with that.
That was a part of it. Like when the overwhelming list of achievements shows up.
Right.
You don't need to. I mean, yes, it's nice to have all of it, but spending 2 minutes listening to
new achievement, shoes unlocked. New achievement, you lost your shoes. New achievement, you don't have underwear. Haha.
I think that works. Oh, that probably works a lot better as a visual.
Totally
gag. Yeah. Not a visual gag, but almost as an illustration rather than actual text.
Yeah. And so that,
granted, like, don't get me wrong. If I had the physical book, I still would have read all of it. It just wouldn't feel like it wouldn't feel like the same. Like when I'm reading,
it was
a
kind
map
of like get on with it, you know, you like know, kind of a thing because of the pacing. Which is, again, I don't want to, and we'll talk, I actually broke out in our notes like a whole subsection to talk about Jeff Hayes and Soundbooth Theater. So I don't want to harp on the audiobook too much until we like bring in some context and like talk a little bit more about that. I did like the audiobook. It's just like book and audiobook were in conflict for the first half, I think I would say, of the novel, basically until the part two flip.
Yeah. That, but to give the other perspective of it, it is a an extremely light book. Like, it's not super dense. So
right.
It worked perfectly as a book to listen to for a fairly extended period of time. I think I blew through this entire audiobook in like 2 or 3 days at work. Same.
Yeah.
Like, and it's just something that I could listen to and could still absorb very well and enjoy for an extended period of time, strictly in audio while I'm also working, which is why I am fairly confident I'm going to listen through all 7 of these books.
Yeah.
Probably in fairly rapid succession.
Yeah. I think I agree with that. My only caveat that I would say is a little bit different, and maybe this is something we could do for fun. This could be a fun thing. But I think I'm going to take them a little bit slower. I think I'm going to maybe do like one every couple months, because it kind of feels, and I don't mean for this to sound like negative, but it kind of feels like candy, and I don't always want candy. You know what I mean? And so like, candy's
good
every once
in a while. Dude, I fucking love candy. I'm such a fucking sweet tooth.
Yeah, I get it. That's just the closest comparison that I can make. Like,
no, I get that.
We also had to read The Lies of Locke Lamora. We finished and read that. We'll talk about that pretty soon to come out on a Patreon episode as well, probably this week. And yeah, then
just to clarify, you said had to as if it was a...
Oh, no, okay. No. I've been wanting to read The Lies of Locke Lamora for a long time, and in starting and everything else, I was very excited. But then I chose to then jump into, right afterwards, Name of the Wind, which is another like dense, meaty fantasy book. And that's just more my speed at the moment, I think, versus... this kicked off, to be clear, this kicked off me wanting to read more again in a new format and like getting into it. So kudo and credits there. So
yeah,
I really liked it. I think the story on the whole is really good. There is something specifically that we'll talk about that I think is unique to this that I don't think you've ever experienced, but that I was very aware of as we were approaching the end of the book, where this is very much this is a Kindle Unlimited or like a Kindle released book. So it is meant to be this sort of like addictive thing. And then you get to the end and it's not really the end. It's just an episode of TV that you watched that I don't love, but I also understand why it is that way because of the nature of its original publication and yada yada yada. The pilot here in this case is like Hugh Howey's Wool, you know, the Silo TV show was published in sort of the same way originally and kind of piloted the format. And I've read a lot of what I would call like Kindle books that way that are typically not a full-size novel like this, but like 120 pages. And then you like end on a note of like the zombie bearing down on the woman. And you're like, oh, well, now I got to go spend 90 cents and buy the next one. So that it just kind of is the vibe of this novel as well at the beginning. I hear that dissipates as he like found a readership and whatnot. But that was also something that I like kind of couldn't ignore. This book doesn't so much end as it does like stop.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. I think that's good on my overall thoughts. Do you feel good on yours?
I feel good. Yeah. Overall positive with a couple little gripes here and there, mostly about the format. Yeah.
What do you rate out of 10? Like what's your vibe?
I am, as we talked about with the House of Gucci, I feel like I am somebody who if I have negative feelings about something, those dissipate a lot more quickly than positive things
sure.
do.
Yeah. You were more positive on this book than I was when we were talking about it as well.
Yeah, that's true too.
As we were reading it, but
I think I'd give this a solid 8.5.
Cool. I'm an 8. I'm a solid 8. People who have listened to the show know that I don't give out 7s or very rarely. I think that's like a weird like breaking point. I view this book as more of a wide recommend, which is why it's above a 7. I think I could recommend this to a lot of people and they would really enjoy it. But it could have been a 9. Unfortunately, I really don't like a lot of the worst of the lit RPG mechanics that are in this. And I kind of have my gripes there. And like the logic loopholes are like a different thing that like, I'm like, ugh, I don't know. We'll get into that specifically. That's what dropped it like a full point grade for me though. But again, really like it, would recommend it to a lot of people.
Yeah.
It just has like a couple of things that, that really like feel like a cheese grater on my arm that I don't love.
That's not a good feeling.
No. And now I've brought in the Greenbone Saga into the conversation. So let's start with the premise. This book starts with a crazy bang. I do really appreciate the way that it kind of kicks off and like leads us into this idea of like, here is Carl's life. It's kind of mundane. He's a retired or like an ex Coast Guard guy. So has like a little bit of military experience, but kind of just an average Joe. He's in the process of sort of despondently breaking up with his girlfriend or finding out that his girlfriend cheated on him. And so, you know, it was just kind of taken aback by that whole situation. Yeah.
Yeah. Basically, they've broken up, but the weather has made it logistically difficult to complete that process.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Because she's stuck in the Caribbean, right?
She's not stuck, but there was a big snowstorm, so her parents weren't able to come get the cat or something like that.
Yeah, that's what's left them with Donut. But I don't.
She was still in the Caribbean.
Yeah, she was still in the Caribbean, right?
Yeah.
So he just still has Donut because the parents couldn't come get her. But
yep.
Mm-hmm. And Donut is this very regal, well-bred, short-nosed, long-haired cat with an attitude.
Is a short-nosed cat something? I'm not a cat person at all. I'm
like a squished face, like a little bit.
I get that, but is that a desirable trait in a cat?
It depends on if that's your thing or not. But like,
okay,
it's a certain breed, right? Like, I don't know, people like French bulldogs. I don't at all. I think they're gross.
Mm-hmm. I just know it was touted as a very, very expensive show cat.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's more like pedigree and like, you know, kind of everything else there too. But I don't know basically anything about cats. I barely know anything about dogs. So here we are. Now we're here. Yeah. But yeah, so fancy cat goes outside, you know, out into the snow. Is he in Chicago? Are they in Chicago?
Seattle.
Ohio? Seattle? Oh, Seattle.
Yep.
Yeah. 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 One else is from Ohio, I think, that we meet later.
Maybe. Yeah. I think so.
Yeah.
But there is something to be said about this serendipitous, the way that Princess Donut,
timing
against all of her former predilections, I guess.
Yeah.
Jumps out of the window and effectively saves both of them from the crushing
transformation.
All the buildings. And I'm curious your thoughts on if she sensed that something was coming or if this is just happenstance.
You know, there's always that like that question of, or like the sort of like superstition that like cats are very intuitive creatures comparatively to a lot of others. And so I tend to believe, especially given her sort of like sentience that we get a little bit later, that she did get a vibe and was just like, yeah, fuck it. Something's weird.
But I also, because of her sentience later, believe that she would have gloated about that.
Yeah, that's true. True.
It seems like something she would have held over him.
Mm-hmm. Especially considering all that she knows and all that she like brings up and like rubs in his face, you know, over and over and over again. I do think that kind of points to, again, not that this book isn't well edited or anything like that, but that might be like a developmental edit that someone might add.
And that might be something that comes up later. Who knows?
Totally. Yep. Again, one book, long series, and all the books get a lot progressively a lot longer. So this is very clearly like dipping the toes in. Second book is a similar length. And then from there, they're like, they blossom and bloom into much larger affairs. So
yeah, we know, as it's been stated, the dungeon goes down to level 18 and they end on like level 2 or the end of level 2, something like that.
No, so, yeah, they end at the end of level 2. Does it end at 18?
I think it
was deeper than that. I thought no one had made it further than 17.
Yes, and I think 18 is the end.
Or 13. Man, I thought it was longer than that. Okay, all right. Regardless, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We could work backwards. I know there are two entrances to level or to the final level.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure it's 18.
I know that there's a wiki. It is 18 levels. You're right. Yeah. I do think that that number of 17 then is higher. I bet it's like 13 or 14 or 15 because no one had made it through a couple of levels below. No one had made it to 18, but I think Mordecai was done on like 14 or something like that. Like that's when
11
pulled.
11. Because after level 10, they start like offering outs or something like that.
Right. Right, right.
I only know that because I recently started re-listening to it.
Totally fair.
A couple days ago.
I just haven't. It's been a little bit here, in part because I've been reading all these other things and having a great time there. But yeah, so very, very fun kind of premise and concept as we get into this. You know, the transformation happens. All of these buildings are suddenly eroded. There's a giant announcement that kind of comes into all of our characters' heads as they're told to head to the dungeon or die. As Earth is being harvested.
Because Earth never responded to the to the, like, summons or whatever. Like,
it is a very Hitchhiker's-esque premise in that way of where it's like, well, we sent you the paperwork. You never responded. We gave you 60 years to respond. You didn't. So we're collecting on the planet that we invested in, you know, 3,000 years ago and seeded or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. It is very Hitchhiker's esque.
Yeah, which
very,
is totally great.
Very Adams.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I was trying to figure out what it reminded me the most of, and I think that kind of nails it.
Yeah, Douglas, it has a lot of that sort of Adamsian tone, although like not the same. Okay, hang on.
There's a shared DNA for sure.
Yes, I want to land this ship though specifically. So where the Handbook to Surviving Medieval England, or whatever Brandon Sanderson wrote, was an aping directly of Hitchhikers in so many ways and in so many different presentations, this is more inspired and borrows from. Like, this is not an imitation of, but it borrows from.
I think done very well, too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Compared to, you know, Handbook. Which I gave
Frugal
it
Wizard's
six,
Handbook
by comparison
to Surviving Medieval England. Yeah,
it's titled wrong in our search, and I've kept it that way intentionally since because fuck, I couldn't keep track of the name.
That was a miss.
And I will never.
Sorry, Brandon.
Yeah. So, anyway, it does have sort of like that tone and like some of the achievements and some of the like AI over voice and things like that. Let's get into the premise once we get into the dungeon, then, of course, which is, hey, we're now in a kind of video game, a pseudo video game. Kind of, I say pseudo, it's more of a real video game. Pseudo is a little inappropriate. It's
pretty much
just not
exactly.
Because it's like their lives, I guess, are at stake. So it's a little different that way. So this brings us into kind of the conversation of the genre of lit RPG and how you feel about it. Like, what were your thoughts kind of upon initial? And then, like, how do you feel about, I don't know, inventory abuse to beat things and whatever else?
Well, Crossland, what would you say is my brand of magic systems?
Well, hard magic systems. But what's interesting is this isn't...
It's not a magic system.
It kind of does, but it kind of doesn't. I mean, I get it, but...
Like there's an ability to suspend disbelief when it comes to like video games,
mm-hmm.
because that's just the world you live in. But when you're you bring like there's just something that doesn't work as well in my brain in my ability to suspend disbelief when you're actively fighting against like the main character and the perspective that you're in. Is actively fighting against the things that are happening to them because it's so unbelievable. And it, like, I don't
so
know.
You're
if
saying
it's,
you had problems like kind of taking it in to some degree because.
Yeah. To a certain extent, I play a lot of RPGs or I used to when I didn't have a child.
Yeah.
And it, like it, the inventory system, the at least the way it was described as like from previous iterations of it, as opposed to what it is now in this version of the dungeon, felt very Diablo. With the like inventory slots and like a fixed amount of space that you have in your chest and things like that. Like I can visualize it, I can understand what they're going for, but it's the real life person living in a video game and understanding the mechanics because of their experience playing video games. Like I can understand how it works, and I can understand how you would like it. It just doesn't work for my suspension of disbelief kind of brain.
Yeah, same, but harder, worse than yours. I feel there's a level of artifice to something like this, right? And I definitely believe that I'm a person of whom can turn my brain off and just enjoy something more than some people can, right? I believe that I have a wider canons of probability than a lot of people have in that range. However, the sort of self-referential things to like real game mechanics without the like implied design effort in the intent of interaction, like there's just it almost feels like disingenuous, which is where that's my biggest problem with the book, period. Like is the little RPG genre-esque elements, like the abusing the grenade function, which is such a critical point in the novel of like, oh, because of the timing, when they pull it out, it'll then explode and like whatever else for like a big moment that happens. It's just like, I exasperatedly sighed a lot more in this novel than I wanted to.
Yeah.
But because it was predictable, because like yeah. I play video games, but like when I think up the clever, cool thing, it's a little different than what I'm just like told the clever, cool thing, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I get it. I get that.
Yeah.
And that said, there's all these, like the other thing that annoyed me along those lines was the referencing of the, like the rule against trying to break the mechanics of the game.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing ever really manifested in that way. It just made the stakes, I guess, a little bit higher in trying to pull off these clever things.
Yeah, specifically with like the rage elemental. It was like more of like a, you know, a barrier.
With that, right? Or with the grenade.
Yep.
I think mm-hmm. that would fall into that category too, or the indestructible tables, or was that part of the rage elemental thing?
I think that was part of the rage elemental thing, yeah. But that wasn't even what I was referencing. I was thinking about how they actually get rid of it using the stairwell.
That
but,
too. Yeah.
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 It is a core function of the genre, apparently. But to my, to my view, not knowing the genre, it is a core function to the way that this book is constructed.
Mm-hmm.
And so it feels like a major gripe to like really harp on that.
Yeah,
but it's also like not that big of a deal to me, and is like I can overlook it pretty well. Like, hence the 8.5.
Yeah, conveniently, the rest of the story—not conveniently, but like the rest of the story—is so good that it makes up for that fault of its sort of like genre choice to some degree. I had a meeting with the girls from Books and Baddies right before this, and right at the end, they were like, oh, what are you recording on? And I was like, Dungeon Crawler Carl. And they were like, oh, is it really good? And I was like, yeah, it's kind of, in some ways, the way that I compared it is like the quote, boy equivalent quote of like a crappy smut book that's like just for fun and like you're just reading it for like a specific thing and you're trying to get one thing out of it. This feels very similar. Like, but the one thing that it has above that to some degree that elevates it from like genre, what they call it, what was old genre science fiction called? Like the sort of like old like penny books and whatever else that you could get, the sort of like trash science fiction, is that the characters are excellent and that I think that the humor often works incredibly well.
Yeah.
So, you know, again, like an 8, it's a great book, but to me the lit RPG mechanics are the things that truly prevent it from being excellent, which is where I think that the adaptation that we're supposed to get will be incredible. So, I'm almost more excited for that because I do think that game mechanics translate generally better into a filmic medium than they do into a book medium.
All right.
So.
I'm down with that.
TV series from, sorry, maybe people don't know this, but Seth Rogen's production house picked it up to develop a TV series. So after doing like The Boys, Preacher, you know, Invincible and all these other shows. So it great track record, incredible stuff. Yeah. Sounds good to me. But talking about more of the lit RPG stuff and maybe some of just the adjacent stuff. How'd you feel about the like AI foot fetish joke? Were you good with that one or did that one put you off?
I think it worked better than it would have worked in print, in audio, because of like the really creepy voice kind of leaning into it a little too hard.
So I actually liked Jeff Hayes' spin on it quite a bit. I just felt like it came up too much to be like it super did come effective. Up. Like it was too often.
It was pretty often. It was pretty often.
And especially for a book that's meant to be like devoured. You know what I mean? Like this is a paced novel. So you got to like space out those jokes or like it's different if you're reading something that's like 700 pages and you have that joke inserted like five times. But we got it like 10 times in 300 pages, you know, like that's.
Yeah, we did get it quite a bit.
Yeah.
I didn't think it was terribly egregious.
No, but just like. But it was. That's kind of like the other note, like rein it in, you know.
Yeah.
How about this gets into the plot a lot later, but the like glorp glorp segment. I loved it. Fucking loved it. And that was actually the moment we'll talk about the audiobook in particular in its own kind of sub breakdown in a minute here. But that was one of the best moments of production that the audiobook pulled off.
That's for sure true. Absolutely. It did make me want some visuals in that respect.
Yeah. I can imagine. So, like, it popped into my brain.
That was a fun little segment. And also an example of something that was brief and well played and memorable, repeatable, catchy, and not over the top. Like, it was played to be over the top, and it still wasn't as over the top as the foot fetish thing. Like, yeah, it was intended to be over the top.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Right.
I think that fit. I think that worked better in a comedic sense.
Yeah. I agree on
glorp, glorp.
All fronts in that case. I really liked a lot of the humor. I would say that like 85% of it landed versus like Brandon Sanderson's humor. I think I'm closer to like a 50-50, but I can skip over the bad ones and like it doesn't impact the story. But the bad ones here were so cringy that it was like when it didn't work, it really didn't work in a weird way. But like infrequently that way, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Don't mean to continue to draw the Brandon Sanderson comparison, but they are both two very big pop authors, you know? So
does Matt Dinneman have any other series, or is this the kind of major focus in his works?
He did, if I remember correctly, and I haven't looked into this in a bit, he did write other books before this. I want to say he did two separate series of books before this. But this is like his big three different series before this. Kaiju Battlefield Surgeon, which I think is a short story that just came out, or a novella. It's supposed to be really good. Dominion of Blades, which is like a fantasy thing. And then The Shivered Sky, which was like more of a serious angels and demons sort of esque story.
So like a wide range of genres. And
but he's an indie pub author, so he just like kept churning them out, you know, which isn't a bad thing. But like he was like writing a lot of different genres and finding it, and then like took off with Dungeon Crawler Carl to the point of now these books went from indie darlings to, you know, I mean, being optioned as an independent audio production facility, which Soundbooth Studio does, and like some of the craziest production print right deals that have ever been done, where whoever publishes these, Ace Books only publishes the physical copy and they have no other rights, which is crazy. That's never the way that those things go. And they don't get the book for a full year after it's been published with the original cover art as Matt Dinneman self indie pub releases it. So they don't get to do, for instance, the seventh book is out now. The seventh book won't come out in their cover until I think late this year.
That seems odd.
It's crazy. that's how successful this series is. It's genuinely like a massive, massive cult hit.
Interesting. Good for him.
Super bizarre. Super, yeah, I mean, incredible to go from like, you know, indie obscurity to like driving a weird, an interesting change in the way that people publish books. So,
yeah.
Hopefully it gets to be a blueprint for some folks. So I did want to talk a little bit about this just before we move on from like the genre lit RPG stuff and start getting into more of the meat of the story. And this sounds, my goal here is to just like put all of our complaints in the beginning so then we don't ever have to talk about it again. I had a problem as well with the sort of explanation of mechanics very literally. I can understand where that's necessary, but so much of it was so literalized either through the AI speaking or Mordecai explaining things, where it didn't feel like our characters were exploring nearly as much as I wanted them to be to figure things out independently.
Yes, and that was also at odds with the times where it was explored in a physical sense. Like when we first encounter the goblins and Carl is realizing, maybe it wasn't the first encounter of the goblins, but like when he first levels up a little bit and suddenly his punches are a little bit stronger and he's like kind of feeling out how hard he's actually hitting. That's, I liked that. But it's at odds with the like crunchy numbers of stats.
Yes.
And how that's implemented within the story as well.
You're so right, and you got to my number one gripe about the game mechanics here entirely, which is the fucking health bars. I texted you about this, but like one of the problems that I have with a lot of the writing specifically around one of the boss fights, I can't remember specifically which one it was, but like they do a little bit of damage and the health bar pops up as they do all the time. And it's like, we just described the fact that the health bar is going down as they're taking damage, as opposed to the wear and tear on the thing. Like when you hit it with something, why don't I get like, let's say it's a car, right? Why don't I get like the leaking fluids or like all of these other descriptive languages? Instead, I get this like simplified, dumbed down description of like a health bar moving down with like some little stuff on the side. And it's like, no, just cut the health bar bullshit and tell me what's happening to this thing as they're doing damage to it through literal description. Like, give me, it's the worst show and tell. I don't like showing and telling are both important in stories, but in my opinion, the tell of the health bar is too much. It is my least favorite element.
In my estimation, treating this like D&D would work better than treating it like Diablo.
Absolutely. Yeah. Give me. Yes, you're so right. In my head, when I was reading this, I was comparing it to listening to Critical Role as a comparison point.
That, I think that's probably why that I spent a lot of time listening to Critical Role while working. It fits that same sort of niche in my head as I was talking about, like, can listen for longer periods of time, really consume it, still work at the same time.
Yeah
but like D&D, you don't know necessarily how much, or some dungeon masters might handle
most
differently,
don't tell
but
you
but most don't tell you how long it'll be before the monster's dead, but they will give you sort of indications of when
narrative
it's clues. Crossed a certain threshold. And it, like older editions of D&D had a condition called bloodied, where it was below 25% health, I believe, was the threshold. If it crossed below 25%, you'd get sort of a descriptive indication that it is in the bloodied condition. But that's not numbers, and that's not a health bar. It is a progressive
description
of the state of the monster you're fighting, as opposed to a never-changing state of monster with a diminishing health bar, like you get in something like Diablo. So I can understand mm-hmm. the pull that's happening from the different games that might be influencing this genre in general or this series specifically.
Totally. And yeah, that was my immediate comparison, was like a Matt Mercer or a Brinley Mulligan, because that's been so at the forefront of my life for the last couple of years. And just that, I think that was one of the things that like pushed against me the most, was the sort of like health situation, which is, it's also such a stupid concept, you know, like it's such a dumb, it's necessary to communicate in early games when we needed that kind of a thing. But now effects and like particles and like you do see these things like weaken, and health bars have just become less and less necessary in a lot of games. So mm-hmm. I don't know. I was just it was one of those things that like really rubbed me wrong, versus like moments where I knew that Matt could do it, but just like didn't, because he can do great description. He does a lot of the time, but it was just like, and I applied a shortcut to this paragraph, and I was like, no, give me the fun. Give me your like, you know, give me your leaking car. Give me the goblin ball, like, or the orc ball stats, and like tell me random pieces and arms are falling out all the different directions as like they're rolling around. You know, like there's so much more fun that could be had if you didn't do health bars.
Yeah. So. Finishing moves in general, like bring in some Mortal Kombat brutalities.
Yeah. Right. Great call. Yeah. Yeah. Be such
punch
a good
through somebody's
like,
heart.
Oh, it's my time. Yeah. Kick, you know, as he's like being this, like, you know, with
kick
feet,
someone's
right?
heart out, kick someone's throat yeah. out.
Yeah. So that's like my final, like real significant gripe
yeah.
with the book. But that was one that like really kind of stood out to me, and one that I'm leery of going forward. I don't think it would prevent me from reading the books. But again, I think it would prevent me from rating the books higher than an 8 without much more substantive writing in places. Cool. Let's talk about Donut and the characters of the story. I mean, we've mentioned, obviously, Mordecai, of whom is sort of our initial guide that we get through a lot of the story. I think he's really excellent. Princess Donut becomes she was a sentient being, but through the power of a legendary pet box, which is another, like, the loot system is bizarre, but okay, fine. It's a loot system. I get it. She becomes like her own sentient character as a part of the story, which is great and interesting. And was the point in which the book went from, I don't know about this dude, to like, totally get it. Because the banter between Donut and Carl is excellent.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Donut is hilarious. Fucking awesome most of the time. Petulant and bratty and exactly what you would expect from an entitled show cat who has gotten everything she has been pampered and served upon her entire life. But I think the best part of her character is the tilt at which she experienced the world, fully believing that she was actually royalty.
Mm-hmm.
And actually the most important figure in anybody's life that crossed her path, basically. It was great.
Yeah. Yeah. She's just such a force of nature in so many different ways. And I love, you know, like the stats thing again, I'm not going to talk about the lit RPG element of it, but like, it's interesting to like kind of get the general idea of like where these people are and like where they stand and sort of what that looks like. And for her allocation to be like so charismatic in a weird way that like juxtaposes itself interestingly against like, she's pretty standoffish if you weren't like inside of the forced game mechanics. Like, I don't know if I'd like Donut myself as a person, as far as her personality goes,
no,
but like the game's charisma stat is so interesting in that way, because like, yeah, she is charismatic in a way that is awful, you know, mm-hmm. but that's real. Like they're like, I don't know. Yeah. Anyway, it's just, she's great.
I've met people like that.
You're talking to one right now, but just pointing myself out here. Yeah. Donut works so well within the breadth of the story. Mordecai as well. Mention him. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say Donut works really well. And I think Donut works particularly well because of the stark differences in personality between her and Carl. Carl being this like really down to earth. I think down to earth is the right.
No, totally. Yeah.
Right descriptor for him, but just
very realistic, wholesome.
Just a dude.
Like, yeah. An average Joe in a lot of ways.
Total average Joe with some background and traits that perfectly set him up to be decent,
better than normal
crawler.
Yeah. 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 He's really interesting. As far as Carl himself goes, how'd you feel about the like internal narration and then like the sort of character traits, the exploration of his past, you know, gradually over the course of the novel? How'd you feel about Carl?
I don't think I really got a deeper understanding of Carl throughout the novel.
Interesting. Okay.
Yes, we got more of his background and more of his character, but I don't think there was anything particularly revealing, if that makes sense.
I feel like it was all really casual, though, like, and intentionally so, wherein, okay, so, like, let's take his situation with his ex-girlfriend, right? He is afraid of confrontation from our perception based on that relationship, because he has kind of had inklings of this going on in the past, but has never, like, he's suspicious in general as a person, inquisitive in general as a person, but that's not something that's thrown at us. That's not something that's told to us. It's just given to us through the notes of like his own character. Right. So yeah. I think that that's one of the things that I like that Matt Dinneman does really well with Carl, is that it is this casual reveal as opposed to this very, I guess I'm going to keep drawing comparisons to Brandon Sanderson, but like Vin is immediately mousy, you know, Vin is immediately like removed and in like hiding and like doing all these things that are like very immediate versus
Carl's presented as, I don't like drama, but that does, you're right, morph into
it's got a casual long tail on it, which I think plays out better for the character. So I really like, I think Dinneman did a killer job with Carl.
Mm-hmm.
Especially given the first person perspective and point of view there. I have been trying and have been a part of the reason that this episode took us so long is because I've been avoiding first person narratives intentionally for a bit now. And because I've been writing in third person, I was like, you know what? Fuck it. We just got to do it. We got to get it out of the way, because I'm not going to be done editing for like another month or so. And yeah, I was pleasantly surprised and pleased. It's a great, great first person narrative.
Mm-hmm.
And it just grows over the course of the book.
There is one reveal to that extent that felt sudden. I don't want to say unearned, but it felt sudden. And that's the reveal that he had been looking for homes that would accept cats, and like, he was planning on stealing Princess Donut.
And
she recognized that, and the thing that makes me feel like it was kind of unearned is that like he claims that he didn't actually realize that he was doing it in the moment. And like that's a super specific thing to be looking for.
Yeah.
That's the one sort of over the top reveal in my head.
I think that gets to the addictive Kindle format of it all, which is sort of the writing style in a lot of ways. It reminds me of the same sort of thing where it's like, it is often used, a similar technique is often used to like, we aren't setting up Chekhov's gun. Like, we don't see him ever searching on a laptop, you know, to see those kind of things and like put it there. And the Kindle writing formula a lot of the times is, I want to pay this off emotionally because you might understand it without me having done a lot of the setup. Like, you'll get it. But because the story has you bought into so much of the rest of the canons of probability, it gets away with that sometimes. This is one of the good examples of where I think, like, it does. Like, it feels emotional. It feels like a serious moment, and it feels good, but it's not as good as it could have been. And that's the Kindle of it all, as I'm describing it. So, It reminds me a lot of some of the early Wool books, short stories, novellas, and sort of the similar thing, wherein, though, he did eventually pay them off much later. But yeah. that almost seemed like in needing to do it, you know, out of necessity versus having set it up beforehand.
Even then, it felt kind of ham-fisted, where you could have done something totally. Like yep. she points out, oh, you only considered apartments with balconies, or you only mm-hmm. considered specific parameters that would have allowed you to have a cat mm-hmm. without realizing that you were planning on having me. Instead of like, you were only looking for places that allowed pets.
Right.
Like, having it a little bit more obscured maybe would have, for me, maybe that would have paid off a little bit better.
From an editing standpoint or an adaptation standpoint, you tie that in with why she jumped out the window. You know, like if you want that to pay off perfectly in an emotional standpoint, you tie that back to like why she was maybe considering escaping to begin with is like, well, I'm not even sure that you like want me around because you're looking at places with and without and like you're maybe being wishy-washy. It's a small change. Don't get me wrong. But like that's yeah. the type of thing that you would do to like tie that together. Well,
I could see that.
Yeah. Because that gives her like a narrative motivation to like maybe jump out the window, you know, in the mm-hmm. moment, which then leads to him chasing out and being like, no, I really do care about you. And that like backflow of emotional payoff works so well.
Yeah. Yeah, that could work too.
How'd you feel about the bosses of the book and like the concept of bosses and boss areas and the whole thing? I like it personally. I like, not all bosses are created equally in the story itself, but I like the lock-in nature of it.
I do. I like the, like the, now I can't think of another term other than lock-in nature of it.
The close, the like Elden Ring fog door, you know, walk through.
Lots of examples. Yeah. The butcher's palace in Diablo 3.
Yeah. As you, great comparisons with Diablo. Yeah.
It's what I'm thinking of all the time in this.
It is the relevant comparison. So it makes sense.
I didn't, all things considered, I didn't love that it was just specific. Like, it felt like there was something broken in that they plucked specific people out of the world to become the bosses.
Okay, what do you mean?
That feels like a change of the rules when it comes to crafting this dungeon. If we're building this sort of very strict rule-based, like the reason for this dungeon is to give the people living on this planet a chance to win back the rights to their planet. And arbitrarily, seemingly, there are some people that were just not given that opportunity and became villains in the dungeon.
I think that speaks more to the like horror and sorrow of it all, right? Especially the moment of transformation, which I think is the most important element therein, where it's like in my imagination, we throw these giant recyclers on most of the planet. It immediately melts it all down and they just like cherry pick a couple of people that never had a chance. Because I mean, the billions of people on Earth, only, you know, a couple million live the transformation. Yeah. So some of those becoming repurposed for bosses, I think, is an interesting narrative thread in the long run to pursue. I hope that is picked up and kind of ran with, because it would be interesting to see, you know, on like floor 8, what that looks like when you've got like they're only, you know, maybe at that point there are only like 50,000 members of humanity left in total. And some of them are bosses, and you're like, there's an emotional conflict there of like, do I kill the last person of this like culture, or like, do I do something? I don't know. It's such an interesting question to beg. It did feel like there was some cheap humor moments latent in here when I didn't particularly love it. Into that first boss, was it specifically the lady?
Yeah,
that was my least favorite of any of the moments. Although it's not because it was a woman stolen from the world. It was because of the way that it was presented.
I didn't love that either.
Yeah.
That feels like And not to lean on this as an excuse, but that felt like a young writer. That felt immature, and I assume that's something that will be grown from.
Scott Lynch did it too. We'll get to Scott Lynch later, eventually. But I agree with you there. It did feel a little.
I think I texted you about that a little bit too. Some
specifically were a little differently gruntled, not disgruntled, but differently gruntled about that.
It kind of rode the line of some maybe things would be written and worded differently if reapproached.
Yeah, and I mean there are elements of this that also makes sense to some degree of the announcements are coming from an alien species that has no care really for the people or the content or the way that they think about people ethically or morals or anything like that. But it was the internal narration that got me from Carl. He is immature, sure. And that's maybe what we're trying to sell there, but he feels emotionally aware enough to know that that's an immaturity at the very least to acknowledge that. I don't know. Would have been a plus for me personally, but
yep, I feel exactly the same way.
Yeah. Yeah. That said, that was my least favorite of the bosses. The rest were pretty much incredible. I mean, the orc ball was awesome. in general, and that whole idea, the entire every subspecies that the book explored, all of them were great and well thought out.
And this is early enough in the story where we haven't run into other people having chosen other races and classes and things the way that this is already set up to handle that means, I think basically from book two forward, because I think we
will start on floor three in the next book, I assume. So we'll see what assignments look like, but it
feels like it's richly thought through, and hopefully it just gets richer as player characters take on these races and classes and things.
I hope simultaneously that the inventory system doesn't become unmanageable to some degree from a mental load, coggy load standpoint for us. Yeah,
I appreciate that it's basically infinite.
Right.
Because then it's not so clunky. It's more hand wavy.
Yeah, but simultaneously, it's what are the rules when you're trying to be mostly rules driven to solve your problems?
It's infinite. Whatever you can hold, you can hold. It's fine. Not dwelling on that going forward might be good.
Yeah, yeah. I was even thinking about it from the standpoint of the inventory system implies that you could pick up full cars and keep them in their pocket, as we get with the goblin glider and other things that you can just drop out, which is neat. But then why wouldn't you just pick up everything all the time and just stuff it in your inventory, That's where my brain breaks with some of this is it turns into Fortnite. And you should, if you're a real player in the game, you should pick up absolutely everything. It might get difficult to sort through when you eventually are panic sorting through menus, I guess. But I don't know.
There's a decent amount of pressure, just external pressure, being chased and being driven by the clock.
Right. And the clock is such a good element of the story. It really forces things, which is great
for sure. Maybe we'll run into some player characters that just have everything and just have piles of corpses,
sheets of metal, piles of corpses. Skulls next to the name, you reminded me, the stars and the skulls as well.
That's something else too, which leads
the nameplate meta.
The nursing home.
Oh man, dude. Fuck, man. I all right We got to talk about it. It was my favorite plot beat of the whole, like, this is what, like, really sold this on me from being like a six of like, I think people could super like this if they're specifically in a niche, or, you know, like if they like this kind of thing, they'll love it. And I would recommend it there to like everyone could read this, because this between the old people of the retirement home and the, and everything that was going on there. And honestly, the Frank Q and Maggie Mai plot, I think both of those are incredibly heartbreaking in their own rights.
Yeah.
How'd you feel?
It reminded me of nothing in particular, but specifically of like Fallout. And that's the game that came to mind first and foremost for me in deciding to make an alliance with a faction out of pure wanting to do good. You know, you're not going to benefit much at all. But there's also, at the same time, some very, very rich characters
so that come out of this. Oh, my God.
All of them. All of the, I mean, not all of them. All of the staff that were still committed to helping the nursing home residents. Not so much the nursing home residents themselves.
Right.
But, you know, that's, what can you expect?
Yeah, I mean, like, the entire plot that surrounds, you know, Meadowlark, which is the name of the facility that was above ground, and what is it, like, Agatha with her shopping cart, and also, like, larger questions, because it seems like maybe she's some kind of, like, secret rebel, which is interesting.
It seems like she's a plant in, like, she has
a corporate plant from a different company, though.
Yeah.
Like a spy.
But plant. Somebody, like, she's in on it more than anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's a fun dangling thread for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's like Jack, Yolanda, you know, Yolanda dies, unfortunately, but like the whole crew that kind of manages to, you know, they take out the ball of swine, which we already talked about. But then in addition, they kind of lead everyone, you know, down. And then I can't remember the old man's name, of whom has dementia and forgets that he can't pee wherever he wants, but then spawns the rage elemental. And oh, my God, what a sad, like,
yeah,
I can't remember his name either. Jack, maybe, but I don't remember.
It sounds right.
Ugh.
I don't know. Yeah, that's something that I think I would have done differently.
As a person, you mean?
Hmm? No, as like if I were to write, like, not to say that I'm... Yeah.
No, but speculating.
Speculating. If I were to write this, we've well-established rules about not using the bathroom.
Mm-hmm. The restrooms.
And you not using the restrooms.
No, I just... Yeah.
Sorry. I don't know. What fucking whatever.
you're so right on bathrooms, for the record. I was just like, I remembered like restrooms specifically, and they're like, we gave you restrooms this time, blah, blah, blah. And
yeah. So yeah. Like,
oh, yes. The specificity of restrooms.
So I think you vilify the corporation more by them adhering to the rules so much that even an incontinent old man pissing himself instead of peeing on the wall spawn the rage elemental. Like something jumps out, scares the literal piss out of this guy, or out of everybody, but this guy like pisses his pants, and that spawns the rage elemental.
That would be, oh my God, that is, ouch, you're right. That is like a level up of heartbreaking in premise.
Right, because you can't blame him for that. Right. And you still can't blame him for what he did, given his like cognitive state. But this that feels like a more concrete, like, these motherfuckers.
Right.
You know, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But who the fuck am I? You know,
no, well, I totally get it. Totally get it. And I'm with you there. Like, it's tough to make those calls. But as we're thinking about like adaptation and like some of these other stretches, I don't know. You know, that's the benefit of reading stories as narrowly as we do and as much as we have, is you kind of get the idea of like, what's this look like if I wanted to construct one myself? So I get it. The nursing home hit really hard for me. I mean, for a variety of reasons, obviously, just from the idea of like what humanity looks like when it survives. When I was reading this, listening to it and walking around my path that I do every day, that's either 4 or 6 miles, depending on the path that I take, brings me past a retirement home community of which people are being like outside and walked around and seen to one way or another. And I was reading this, listening to it one day when I was like walking past and like looking at the people simultaneously. And there was this one, and it's so Agatha. Agatha is like a completely different thing. She's not actually, you know, the person that we thought she was when it showed up. But there was a woman of whom someone had left like a Walmart shopping cart pretty near to like this like little lake. And she was like steering it down towards this like puddle, this pool of like water, you know, it's like a little mini pond. And her assistant was just like chasing after her and like knocking over the cart and like trying to like get her to turn around. I was just like, what an accurate depiction in so many ways of the same sort of thing that was going on. And I am so deeply moved by like this one little segment of this book. Also in respecting the idea that like, they would make it and that the caretakers would do well and that the janitors care about people enough to take care of them. There's just like a positive element of humanity in the dystopia as well.
It totally shifted the vibe of the story from strict video game on page to like an actual dystopia, like apocalyptic novel and like the human stories that would come out of it.
I deeply loved and appreciated that book. I was kind of bummed, but understandable that like we do leave them at the very end of the story and we settle in that direction because I liked them so much as an element, but also logically for the story to progress, that makes sense.
As
said, but, like survival is going to be tough.
Knowing
and,
that
and the people who chose to die in the Waffle House, oh my god.
But knowing that Matt Dinneman can write this sort of plot gives me a lot of hope for future additional subplots. I'm not gonna hope that they like feel the exact same, but subvert my expectations of what's going on with this video game book, you know.
Yeah, because the overarching thing there is interesting enough, but it isn't enough to do the rest of the work. But he knows how to do the rest of the work, which is why this is good. That's why I like this.
Yeah.
And I'm with you there. Yeah. That's why I got the second book and I actually bought it and didn't spend a credit on it when it was on sale on Audible. So
nice.
I was like, perfect. It was like,
I'm probably going to listen to that tomorrow. Sweet.
Yeah.
Totally.
We've both been like kind of hanging out waiting until we recorded this episode to begin the next. So
I easily could have listened to it all the way through, but I really wanted to.
We could be on book 3 or 4. I mean, by like math's sake, since we finished this book technically for the first time, but time has not been on our side here and there, but we've made it nonetheless. But that whole thing, and the rage elemental is spawning itself. How'd you feel about dealing with the rage elemental and like the handling therein?
We use manipulations of the mechanics, as we've already discussed.
Some bad and some good, though, I think.
Some
in terms
good,
of like,
bad
some
and
of
some
it's good and some of it's like, okay.
In a vacuum, I loved it. Yeah, like in sort of the self-contained, is it one chapter? Is it a couple chapters? I can't remember.
It's like two.
Whatever it is. But in that, ignoring the rest of the story, I really loved the way that the whole thing plays out. The implications of the way that it plays out is where I have problems with it. But that's like, that's neither here nor there when talking about the actual very intense, very action-packed sequences that we get of a heavy planning session and a chase scene. And like, it is,
it's a very critical role once again.
Yeah, and almost nonstop action through all of it. Mm-hmm. It's great. It's so much fun. And it's really well described for the most part. Like, I talk about my like lack of ability to like visualize things, but I had no trouble visualizing what was going on here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had more of an issue personally with some of the scenes that I think happened with the swine ball when they were like, when it was like rolling into the fort that they had built. Yeah. There were some like kind of things there was like, it kind of felt like we were skipping sentences almost, or like whole, you know, I don't know, explainers. But this, the Rage Elemental, I felt like was really well played. This gets into sort of the Kindle of it all once again, but like this feels like it should have been like primary climax of the novel to some degree, and it isn't.
I thought it was. I thought it was going to be.
It kind of felt like it should have been, or it's given that much weight and that much importance in the story. Instead, we get kind of two different interviews and their importance therein, which we'll definitely talk about. But it's intriguing because like nothing beats the Rage Elemental in terms of difficulty, you know, for the rest of the novel. The Burrow Boss, sure, but not really. Like,
right.
I don't know. I don't even, PJ, we read this book like a month and a half ago. I don't even remember the Burrow Boss. I remember everything else, most everything else about this book. I don't remember what the Burrow Boss was at all.
Was the Burrow Boss the worded out bro guy?
Maybe. Was he? Was it?
I don't.
That sounds right.
I don't remember if that was the Burrow Boss or just another boss.
I don't remember at all, which speaks to the level of like that was supposed to be like the big fight. And like, was it?
Yeah, this was for sure the big fight.
It felt like the big fight. Yeah.
And at the same time, like, I don't know if the interviews and like the way that this turns into popularity and like sponsorships and things like that's something that I'd also like to talk about. So remind me once I get done with this sort of tangent. I don't know if that would have worked as well if that was shifted between books. Like if we had a climax of the Rage Elemental and then we like came back to it or started talking about the sort of audience interaction with the story, like not our, not the readership, but like the in-universe alien audience interaction of it. I think it only really works if it's immediate, you know?
Totally.
Like, I don't know if that would have worked as well separated by books.
No, I think you're right. I think you're right in the payoff standpoint. Like
it's kind of damned either way, where this feels like it should have been the climax of the story, but also it makes the mechanical payoff of sponsorships and things not work out as well. But that said, as far as like crunchy number shit goes, when it comes to levels and like skill numbers and things like that, we don't get that same crunchy number shit when it comes to audience interaction and sponsorship and things. Like we do get physical numbers, but we don't get a meaningful translation into what that actually means.
Because like it's not a game mechanic that can be replicated. It's not like a thing that exists on like Twitter or Instagram. Like it's a vibe. It's not literal, which is so important. It's just
big number feel good.
Yeah. Yeah.
But also what are the, like we're dealing with billions, we're dealing with millions, we're dealing with, but what does it fucking mean? We don't know if it, what it is in relation to anything else.
Which is, I think, a good thing. Do you agree? Like, I think that's a good thing.
I think it's a good thing, but also it's a good thing, but we're made to care about it. And I can't.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
No, I don't think we get enough. Maybe that's to the whole point.
In that, like, we're supposed to see how their perception of it works through the eyes of the uninitiated in Carl and Princess Donut, not understanding what the scope of these numbers are. So, good point. I don't know.
Yeah, it's. I'm with you. I think that it's tough to fully determine,
and that's something that I think will get more solidified later.
Yeah, I think in general it'll make its way out of this and it becomes something that is more clean cut than we're, well, but I also personally, I almost don't want it that clean cut. I like this like kind of amorphous idea because so much of the story is so explained in so many ways, or it's like so literalized that like leave a little bit of, you know, magic on the social table. Just,
I think that's my problem with it in that.
Sure.
I wish it was more
soft
uniform.
Within the hard.
Yeah. I don't want necessarily it to be so perfectly hard, but I want the rest of it to be a little bit softer to match.
Sure.
Like it's the
you're right. That's
very
actually,
different
that's,
sort of approaches on things.
That's more the vibe. Yeah. I get it. Did you want to go off on it? Was that the popularity tangent that you wanted to
that
go off on?
That was the popularity
was there anything
thing.
Else? Okay.
Yeah.
Just want to make sure that we represented that. That kind of brings us to the interviews and then maybe to like Frank Q and Maggie Mine. I think that's most of the book. But the first interview is excellent in and of itself. It's a really interesting portrayal. We get to kind of see the larger world for the first time, universe, as it were, through the eyes of this otherwise incredible character of whom, again, is jokeified to such a level that I kind of had a problem at first. Just the descriptions copiously of the breasts, like, was just like a lot. I don't know if you felt the same way. Like it was so much.
Yeah.
That like it wasn't it hit a funny note the first time, but then it was like so much that he was like trying to divert his eyes often and was confused and aroused and whatever else. And I was just like, I don't know. Don't love
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I feel like I remember, and maybe I'm not remembering it correctly, and maybe this would have worked better, but
sure.
the word grotesque, was that a feature of the description?
That was a feature of the description of other parts of the crab body, of the like, you know, the sort of like scythes for hands and other things like that, but not the breasts, which were like...
Fair enough.
Often like plump and full and, you know,
yeah,
just
you're
like
right.
A lot of like, but like also like copious, like aggressive and like, you know, overflowing in weird ways. And
yeah. I don't know what to think of it, man. It's just weird.
Yeah. Yeah. It was weird and not fun. Like not as fun as a lot. Like the rest of it was good, but I was just like, it's not even that it's like sexual by any means. It's just like, we're just doing this.
Just okay, kind of lingered fine. Upon.
Yeah. Way too leering of an eye. You know, I say this being a Stephen King fan. Stephen King has a leering eye sometimes, or a lingering eye sometimes on things like this. Robert Jordan did as well with The Wheel of Time. But like, this was way more off-putting than a lot of the others. It's just so weird. I think it could be just because of how like, quote, foreign, quote, it all feels. But
yeah. Yeah, I'd agree. But the reveal of it all being
armor and gear,
prosthetic,
you know,
and armor, yeah, was fun.
Crabs they kill every day, you know.
Yeah, yeah. That was the funniest part. Was like, oh no, this isn't one crab body. This is,
and we kill new crabs every day.
we don't reuse crabs.
Yeah. Yeah, that was, it's a fun reveal. In addition, it gives us some of the back context for some of the universe. Are you curious more about the wider universe? Like, where does your curiosity extend?
I guess that kind of leads me into wanting to talk more about Mordecai.
Okay.
Yes, I am curious about the world at large, or the universe at large, as it was, or is. And how all of these people that we've interacted with or have been exposed to are in different positions because of their success or perceived success or partial success, whatever you want to call it, in their own dungeon crawling. But that all, like, understanding that means it's all underpinned with tragedy and loss, and maybe not even underpinned in the case of Mordecai, but the overpinned in Mordecai's case. But every additional iteration of a person from the outside who is there because of their like success through the dungeons just makes this whole universe feel so much more full.
Yeah.
Yeah. I really liked that world building aspect of all of this.
And it begs so many interesting questions. And again, that's like so much of the story through the lit RPG lens is literal. And it's like, this is exactly what it is. And as I'm explaining it, and like, I'm also directly have to tell you those things. That's a problem that I view with in a lot of the lit RPG that I've attempted to read in the past. However, this story begs grander questions. What's up?
Are there other examples of stories that you've read in this? We're not get into that.
Well, I'll just say that I did not particularly personally enjoy the Cradle books. I read the first book there. I've tried a couple of others that have been recommended. There was one about a necromancer that I just didn't vibe with. Not only, again, like the mechanical perspective just becomes too much, in my opinion, for me to enjoy it. This threads that needle, though, brilliantly, like as using this as an example or using the emotionality that we talked about before as an example. So,
okay.
Yeah, cool. Speaking of emotionality, we go from that interview to the second interview, which is sort of the shock moment reveal of Frank Q and Maggie Mai, of whom we met earlier in the book, as sort of like betrayal characters. They're our first example of characters with skulls. And this leads us to the incredible revelation that I think Carl's indirectly responsible for the death of their daughter.
I don't think so.
And I disagree with that idea. They paint it that way.
They paint it that way. He disagrees with that idea.
Yeah. She could have been healed. She would have been wounded, but she could have been healed.
She would have been... Yeah. That's one dangling thing that I hope gets addressed later.
Mm-hmm.
Because it feels so unfinished now. Kind of frustratingly so. In the reasoning behind killing their daughter after she was wounded.
Mm-hmm.
Because she wasn't like... There aren't, as far as I understand, as far as we understand, there's not like bleed effects. It's not like she's draining health and she's going to die eventually and they're stopping the inevitable. Maybe they feel that way, like they don't understand the mechanics of the game or something, but they seem competent players in the game.
Right.
And they never really retort with anything after Carl says she would have been fine. Like, you didn't have to kill her.
Yeah, there's almost nothing, like, deeply meaningful there. And, like, Maggie instead chooses, his wife and otherwise, chooses to strangle her, right? Like, kills her in that moment.
In and a that's just horrifying such, like,
way. Yeah.
They have guns.
For what reason would you choke your child to death? I mean, like, I get like, that she's bleeding out, but Jesus Christ, you'd do anything to try to save them.
I don't think she was bleeding out either.
I mean, she was clearly hurt at the very least.
She was hurt.
I can't say that that's not, like, Carl did accidentally, via the rat trap, hurt her, but didn't, I mean, I don't know. I also feel like Maggie was cold enough that she would have killed her either way at that point because they were already so in on killing people.
Yeah, I don't know. Strangling just feels so...
It's so personal, A, but also
out of
so
left
intense.
Field also, and so slow comparatively to like what they had at their disposal.
Right. Shooter, you know, like... It's like a quicker thing to do as well, just from the standpoint of like, if you have to, why wouldn't you, you know? I think about all the zombie shows that exist in the world, right? Like The Last of Us, like we won't talk widely about specific spoilers, but in the second episode of season 2, there are moments in which many people within the town or within a town are corrupted and we just see them get shot and they like volunteer their own guns. And that's like, that's what you would do in a moment like that, is a moment of understanding. I don't know.
It's still horrifying.
It's still awful. Yeah.
But it's a lot faster.
Right.
Like, it, yeah. That's your only way out. I don't know. Fuck, man. I'm just holding out for a deeper understanding of this going forward. And I don't know if I'll get it, but it does not make a lot of sense to me as it stands.
Totally. And I'm with you there. I think that brings us to close to the end of talking about the book, which is the Maestro. We talked earlier about the sort of group of people going glug glug for his show. What is it, like Death Watch?
Death Watch
Extreme?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's Death Watch Extreme.
Yeah, something like that.
Whatever it is. Yeah. You know what I'm talking about. Glug, glug.
Yeah. Glurp, glurp. Glurp, glurp.
Glurp, glurp. Glurp, glurp. Sorry. Glurp, glurp. I fucked it up, no, of course.
You're so on
glurp,
it, though.
Glurp, glurp. Glug, glug. Am I right?
Glug, glug. And that secondary interview, though, right? Like we had talked about. Like, this is that other conversation, which is one before of where it was like this very like nice manicured relationship. And this is that interesting, according to the media, like conservative buyout and like being able to pull them out in different directions and do whatever they want with them. And do I accept? Well, the Aquarian species, they're not Aquarians, but I can't remember their names. The water helmet people.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
It'll come to me in a moment. But, you know, we lose our primary guide through that, of whom had also managed the first interview, because she broke some of the rules within the dungeon. She ends up coming back at the end, but not until after the Maestro interview. What do you think? What were your thoughts on the whole interview, that perception, and the way that that sort of like crowd movement and moment went?
That still felt clunky to me, but I mean, just specifically the taking over that initial person's overseeing and like,
oh yeah, yeah, yeah. That was very heavy handed. I would agree. Yeah.
Yeah. But
especially because she comes so back so quickly and easily. You know what I mean? Like it just
feels a little too fast. Maybe clunky is the wrong term. I don't know.
I get it.
But in general, this having a liaison for external interviews and like this off the screen sort of behind the scenes peek into the show within the book.
Right.
Was a lot of fun. Like that subverts the sort of we're following a character in a TV show. That is a video game, and like
in a book,
inside of a book,
and that we're listening to. Anyway,
really, really tips the corner and like peels it back a little bit, and we see the behind the scenes and the inner cogs of the machine that we're following along with. So I think it was very well done. I was happy with that. But as far as the specific, like, we have our one liaison, and it worked for one, or she was with us for one interview and then gone for the next and then back afterwards. Like, could have been a slower burn for all of that.
Yeah. I love this segment in particular for a couple of different reasons. I agree with you. There could have been some slower burn moments, especially with sort of our liaison, like you're saying. I'm 100% with you on all of those points. But I love the presentation of, I think it's Li Jun and the other competitor of whom were the people of whom were being raided by Maggie Mai, it seems, in the moment right before the tunnel collapsed. The people of whom are nearly dying, being chased down by these killer animals. And Carl like throws his weight behind to like save them in so many different ways.
Yeah, that's
so cool. So great.
Have to talk about that too.
Yep.
Mechanics of that just didn't work for me either. The being plucked out in real time, and like there's a bubble of slow time field or stop time field, and I don't know. That just,
that for me was the most logical extension of disconnect. Yeah, I was so down with that, because like they break those rules all the time, and also they said that they could previously. So like that was set up to me at the very least. Like that in the first interview was set up. But
okay.
Yeah. That they could yank you out whenever, and then they also had like freeze time capabilities around. So like, wild janky, and I definitely get that. I don't know. That was the one that I was the most okay with from a suspension of disbelief. But I love the emotional moment and like Carl standing up and like that leading to the eventual confrontation where he's like, you either have my ex or someone else. And then the realization, I was live texting you while I was working out that day.
And you went through the exact same train of thought as I did.
It's like, oh, like, it's her.
Totally thought it was B.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But then quickly realized, oh, wait, no, given all the things he's saying, oh, fuck, it's them. And it's Frank Yu and Maggie Mai.
Yeah.
Yeah. Giving them as well the legendary potion to find Crawler, clearly pointing out future conflicts as well. An interesting moment.
Yep. Total. Is it even a Chekhov's gun at this point?
I mean, it's... I think it's not nearly as subtle, more obvious
than that.
Yeah. Yeah. Chekhov's gun implies subtlety to some degree. this is not a subtle
Chekhov's grenade launcher.
Yeah, exactly. Chekhov's hand cannon. There were so many cool moments too, especially with like the goblins and conning them in that I think worked really well. But I did love this whole like naughty little piggy moment that happened as Carl like managed to be charismatic despite not having the charisma score, you know, and shape the sort of narrative. It was very well done. I also love the indictment of Joe Rogan generally through this lens. That was a great, great moment.
That was pretty good too. Yeah.
Yeah. Or Jordan Peterson, whichever you prefer. Both.
Yeah. Which, I mean, we're not even getting into the future of like the memes that come from it.
Right.
And like the deep fake sex tape between the two.
Oh my God. What a moment too, though.
Carl's bad little piggy or whatever.
Yeah. Naughty little piggy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Pork fuck, boy dude. Snick. Cause it was snick is the term for like a sex tape, I think.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so
like
good.
An illicit film. So good. So well done. Do really love it. And them showing back up and potentially having this payoff in the long run could be great. This does lead me, though, to the end of this book, which is, again, the addictive Kindle format of it all. It kind of just ends. It just stops. Sorry, it doesn't end. It stops. There's no denouement. There's no nothing. It's just like, oh, I need the next one now, which is both satisfying in some ways, but completely unsatisfying in others. I get why he did it. Because that's the nature of trying to sell these things initially and like some books and doing it in the way that he did. But I don't love it. I don't love the ending. I mean, like it just, again, we get Mongo, this velociraptor pet, but that's like the last 40 pages is just Mongo.
Pretty much. Yeah. That's pretty much the it.
Which is cute and fun, but like not the end of a story, not the end of a book conventionally. Mm-hmm.
And also, maybe a too fast reveal of, oh, this thing that you've got is actually a velociraptor.
I liked that payoff, but I'm with you. Where, like, that would have been a perfect tease between books, like, to question it a little bit longer of, like, what is it?
You know, question like, it a little bit longer. Like, start to realize it as it grows. Mm-hmm.
Right. And, oh, it's like, so feathered, you know.
And get confirmation of it when it's basically all but recognizable as a velociraptor.
Yeah, yeah. And that's just like, to me, that feels like a confidence thing between books. That feels like something that adaptation will smooth out entirely, you know, when this comes there. But again, I feel like that feeds into the Kindle format of it all, where it's like, you got to do what you can do to tease the next thing and like make sure that people buy the next book. And I don't really besmirch Matt Dinman for it. But in hindsight, as we evaluate it versus other things, it does speak more to the format of publication than it does like intent, I think, of storytelling.
Then I can forgive that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think so, too. I think that I'm able to forgive that very readily because that's the nature of it. But like, I can't help but not point it out at the very least. I do.
Right.
I do like it still, but Mongo is very interesting and I'm very excited for Mongo in the next book as it goes. But
I do like Mongo.
Mongo is pretty fun. Okay. Anything else on the book you wanted to tackle before we get into audiobook specific things to talk about for a second?
Not that I can think of. No, I think that covers it pretty well.
We did even more than I thought we were going to do, to be honest. More came up as we were kind of going that I was like, oh shit, this. So it was cool in that way. I want to talk about the audiobook, though, specifically, because we did mostly both listen to the audiobook. And I kind of have, I don't know, three or four bullet points to talk about. First off, I want to say, I think Jeff Hayes did, as the primary producer and voice actor of most of all of this, did incredible work. His entire idea with Sound Booth Theater is this sort of like place and home for something that makes an audiobook larger than a traditional audiobook is great. However, I do want to just like put the pin in on like people say that this is an incredible audiobook. Love you to death. This is more of an audio drama than it is an audiobook. There's so many more sound effects. It's not a singular performance or like even like a narrative group performance. There are layers of like true like audio tricks done in different settings. And it's not to speak against the total quality of the product that we're buying, because I do think about the second one. I think that it's a quality product. But I think a lot of people say that Jeff Hayes is like as good of a narrator as Stephen Pacey. And I completely disagree. He has more tricks in his tool belt. He is not like a straight audiobook narrator by any stretch. But he's great.
Is he the sole narrator through this entire thing?
Of this book, outside of maybe, and I would just have to double check this, the Glorp Glorps. But he does do all the narration. But he also pitch shifts. Like he doesn't do, not everything is just natural. He also does like pitch shifting on things. He also does like traditional like musician tricks and things that you would do in a DAW, like things that we do, gates and crunches, and, you know, it's production, which is great and should be done and used more. But I can't help but like just be a little bit frustrated with some of the comparisons that, you know, people strike. Okay.
Gotcha. Would have fooled me as far as like
Princess
I would
Donut
have believed
isn't a pitch shift, but. But like all the vocoder effects that he does with the robots, you know, like that's all effects.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
All the achievement unlocks, all of the glorp glorp layering, of which I've already heaped praise on, is like, it's a great touch, but like that's production, not narration.
Yeah. Like I would have believed that there was a cast of.
Oh, yeah.
Voice actors.
He's also a very good narrator. He's top 10 for sure, probably top 5 for me of what I've read in my life, probably like number 5. But I think a lot of people give him way more credit in part because of all the work that he does as a part of that production, as that production studio. He is also the founder and does so much of the work and like deserves the credit. I feel the need to clarify that it's like it's not pure audiobook narration, and that like kind of rubs me the wrong way when people gauge it against, you know, other means and mediums.
Yeah, just unfair comparison.
Yeah, mostly. And that's pretty much it. I've no other real gripes outside of the things that we talked about earlier with the achievements and sort of some of the things that I would have been able to gloss over reading physically versus kind of shoved into.
At the same time, in that respect, on the flip side of it, I don't think it would have worked to just entirely not narrate it, you know? Like I don't think there's a winning formula there. Like I don't know if there's a good way to present.
You would have had to write it differently. Yeah. In order to feed the audiobook well, which I don't think feeds the whole story well.
I don't know for sure, but I'd have to see it in physical to see what it looks like on page. But I can imagine what it would look like, and it's something that can be ignored. But I would read it anyway. But it doesn't contribute to the story in the same way that actual text does. And how to delineate that in audiobook form, it doesn't translate the same way that it needs to.
Yeah, I'm going to screenshot the Kindle here for just a couple that are in a row early on. This is actually the precise section to some degree. hang on. But I do think, for the record, that this gets so much better in the back half of the book that I also like really enjoyed it. As we were both listening to it, we both messaged each other wondering if it would be a better read than a listen, because some of this was so off-putting. I especially felt put out because of some of these things. And I did read quite a bit of it physically, but I do think in the end, in the back half, it did adjust for the format well enough that like both the writing leveled out where this didn't need to be so prominent and everything else worked, that it's like, oh, I could listen to the next audiobook and I will feel fine.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't know. It was off-putting at first, but
you sent me that screenshot and that's exactly what I was imagining it would look like.
Yeah. But like your eyes glaze over the new achievement versus when you're listening to it, he goes, new achievement. And that takes 4 seconds of your life away from you. And then you hear, you're a murderer. He probably had a family. And then reward? And that, like, that's so much fucking time, especially when it's so repetitive that it, like, it just becomes grating to some degree. Especially when it's so many in sequence. It's good in the longevity of the series, I'm sure. But the personal complaint within the first book.
Yeah. Totally agree with you.
The Patrick Warburton of it all. Choosing Carl to have the internal monologue of Patrick Warburton as a voice is a choice. How do you feel about that?
I don't know who Patrick Warburton is.
You know who fucking Patrick Warburton is. What do you mean? PJ,
I don't recognize the fucking name. I don't know.
Have you ever seen Emperor's New Groove?
Yeah.
Cusco's poison. I'm Cusco. I'm, you know, like he's... Oh my God. In like so many different things. He does like the voiceover in a series of unfortunate events. He's an iconic voice. All right. We're going to take like a second here.
No, I'm going to find I know Kronk's voice. I didn't know that was Patrick Warburton.
But like he is just so iconically connected to that tone of voice. And this is literally just Patrick Warburton. Like so much so to a degree that I was talking about the Patrick Warburton of it all in our Discord with our patrons, and one migraine made mention of the fact that, like, well, it's not actually Patrick Warburton. I was like, I never thought that it was actually Patrick Warburton, for the record, but apparently Patrick Warburton shows up in one of the later audiobooks because they broadened the cast to actually be a cast for a hot, like, special guests, not like a full cast, but like some special guests here and there. And Patrick Warburton actually does a voice at some point, which is hilarious and also fucked up. Like you can't have the voice of Carl show up as a voice of a different character. I'm not gonna be okay with that.
That's pretty funny, unless it's like a Carl emulation.
Could totally work. Did you obviously he's also super prominent in Family Guy. That's the other one, right? He plays
I never really got super into Family Guy.
Oh my God, the guy in the wheelchair though. You would know the voice. Also American Dad. I think he plays a voice there. But anyway, okay, fine. I'll give it away. So the voice was not off-putting to you at all. For Carl.
It off-putting, no. I don't know. It was
You're totally fine with his internal monologue, which is totally fine. You are.
Yeah.
Or what? I don't know. Okay.
Didn't bother me, no.
I couldn't handle it. Okay. For a while. It took a long time for me to get inured to it, to a point of where I was like, okay, I can listen to it and like not freak out. But I also think it blended and got better later in the book. Again, like there's something that happens around part two of this book where all of it feels much better. And that's where I also feel encouraged going into the second book. So
yeah.
How did you feel about like the production elements and sort of the audiobook nature of it all? I know, again, we had talked about the difference between reading and listening with this one in particular.
It did feel very well crafted. It felt like there was a lot.
Kudos, again.
Like, a ton of, like, production time that was pumped into this.
It reminded me of the effort that, like, we would put into a season, like, an episode of The Tales of Kana, right?
Yeah.
Like, all
very
of
well
the
polished.
Layered sound production and everything else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I totally... absolutely enjoyed that aspect of all of it.
Cool. Anything else on the book? Anything else that you want to make mention of? Any thoughts thinking forward about the series?
It is like, what is the pacing going to be like? We're 1/7 of the way. I mean, I know you mentioned the other books get longer, but
mm-hmm.
we're 1/9 of the way through the, like, there's going to be some truncation of the, like, some levels are going to go a lot faster than others. I'm sure we'll get through maybe a few each book now. Mm-hmm. But I am so curious where it's all going. And
the series isn't over at book 7, for the record.
Okay.
It's not done. Matt Dinman a couple of years ago said that he had planned an outline for 10 books, but that, like, never say never. So that's all where right. we're at. This is a very live series. PJ, in my own estimation of this, I think you will outpace me in reading this. So what Probably. I would like to do or propose is potentially for us to continue reading these, but I'm going to do it slower than you do for once, and you're going to pull me through, not episode by episode, but by book, because I think that I will be behind you by and large, because All right. I do want to just kind of take them at my pace. But
yeah,
I think that could be a fun little switch.
That would be a lot of fun.
And a logical one, because I think nothing derogatory here, but I think you also enjoy it more than I do. So getting to pull through, you know, a little bit, but you know,
sounds good.
Cool. All right. Well, there we go. This was a grand time. We did talk even more than I thought we were going to about this, but like right on the money for one of our episodes. I was so pleased by this whole experience. I genuinely came in with like a really negative feeling on the first couple of, well, a positive feeling on the first chapter, negative on 2 through 4, and then felt so good about it going out that I'm very excited for the rest of the series here. Glad we got to talk about it finally, because we kind of have been holding in a lot of these thoughts for a bit, you know, given when we finished and read these things. I think it's been like a month.
It has been a while.
Yeah. So it's cool. All right. Well, with that, the next time we do one of these, we're going to be doing The Lies of Locke Lamora. So if you want to read along and join in, Lies of Locke Lamora by Scott Lynch. PJ and I have both already finished it. Can't wait to talk about it. Very excited. The Guy Ritchie of all that is, you know, omnipresent in my brain.
For sure.
So, yeah. Talk about that soon.
If you would like to follow us on social media, you can do so by following us at Words Whiskey Pod on most everything except for Reddit, which is at
/words and whiskey.
Yeah. Yeah. You can also call us at, oh, fuck. Why would I tee that up without the phone number? I don't have a phone number.
I don't know. You teed yourself up so well. Hang on.
Listen to an episode of Words and Whiskey, and you can find the phone number at which you can call us.
It'll also be in the show notes.
Sure. It always is. Yeah, but that's less fun. Get people to listen to our other episodes, Crossland.
No, yeah, fuck. 910-408-2534.
There you go. First listeners of this are already patrons, but if you are listening to this at a later date where we've released it on the main feed, you can join us on Patreon and join the exclusive club by joining us at patreon.com/wordsandwhiskey.
Yes, yes. And again, the next Patreon episode that we're going to be releasing is The Lies of Locke Lamora by Scott Lynch. I'm so excited to talk more about this and that. And I do believe that we will probably continue with this series of novels slowly. I'm not going to commit us to any like significant dates or anything like that, but I think that this could be a nice little run on the side of things. Beyond that, thank you so much for all of your support. Continue following along with the main show. At the moment, we're reading through the First Law series. If you haven't checked that out one way or another, we are deep within the heroes and about to start Red Country and move into the back half of we are in the back half actually of the series. We are approaching closing it out.
Sweet.
So with that, we'll see you soon.
Goodbye.
Bye.